morning. My name is Elizabeth Cosford, and I'm counsel for defendant appellant in this case, the United States. May it please the court, the trial court committed three errors. First, the court erred in rejecting our prior material breach argument. Second, the reduced capital ratios in First Federal's financing agreement applied solely to First Federal and not to future insolvent merger partners like Monroe. And third, the lost profits awarded were not reasonably foreseeable. With respect to prior material breach, while the court correctly found that the modified conversion was consistent with the financing agreement, it incorrectly held that Section 6.04 did not take into not encompass the Canada Trust overture that took place in 1988 and 1989. Under the plain language of the agreement, the Canada Trust overture had to contemplate a common stock offering because Canada Trust wanted a majority stock position in First Federal, and under the
in the agreement, in 6.4, it says, provided that the board of directors recently determined it's in the best interest to
provide
the conversion. So they all agree that they determined that they have the right to, unilaterally determine it's not in the best interest, and that's what they did.
Below, we did not take that position. However, we are not appealing that part of the trial court's decision. What we are appealing is the trial court's decision that under the next clause of Section 6.04, which required First Federal to report progress toward making a common stock offering, that First Federal failed to do that when Canada Trust made its overture in 1988 and 1989.
That assumes that these importunities or inquiries that the board of directors turned down somehow was progress.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
The progress seemed to suggest to people things that the First Federal initiated, not that somebody outside said, hey, how do you like to sell your business to us?
The definition of common stock offering under the agreement was not limited to offerings that were initiated by First Federal. Common stock offering encompassed both standard conversions and modified conversions.
But Judge Friedman was asking about the word progress, I think, not about common stock offering. What does progress consist of? If somebody calls me and says, I'm interested, you want to meet, and I say no, is that progress?
That may not be progress, but that's not what happened here. Over the course of 1988 and into 1989, there were several conversations back and forth between Mr. Borshoff, the president of First Federal, and the representative from Canada Trust. In fact, in February of 1989, Mr. Borshoff went to the Strategic Planning Committee and said, Canada Trust is called again. You know, what should I do? And the unanimous view of that committee was that First Federal should pursue discussions with Canada Trust and learn more specifics about the proposal.
But the board decided not to go forward with any of these overtures. It's hard to characterize that as progress.
The whole point of this notice provision was for the government to have notice of what First Federal was doing towards
someone else.
First Federal was having conversations with Canada Trust. First Federal thought it was important enough to have their Strategic Planning Committee look at it, and they took.
There was an article in some banking journal that suggested the thing the First Federal could do to save itself out of its problems was to see if one of the larger companies wouldn't maybe buy it. Was that something they have to report as progress?
No, because First Federal would have had no involvement whatsoever in that sort of suggestion. That's a suggestion.
Immediately following that, they got a phone call from Canada Trust, which was as follows. Did you see this morning's financial crime? Yes, we did. Would you be interested, perhaps, in selling the company to us? And they said, well, we'll think about it, but probably not. Would they have to report that?
That could be, the word progress is broad. That could be encompassed, but like I said, what happened here was much more advanced than that. And I will also note that in the reports that were made, for instance, in 1988.
You have to show us that what they did was a breach of the contract. Right?
That's right.
A material.
And
right.
It would seem to me that before there'd be a breach of the contract, there'd have to be rather specific indications as to what was done, and you have this general language that they're supposed to report progress.
First Federal,
what is progress is always going to be disputed I say we've made substantial progress, and you say we've made no progress. That happens all the time in relationships.
Well, let's look at what the federal view its obligation under 6.04 to be in 1988, right around the same time. At that time, it had strategic plan type meetings where it merely talked about alternatives to a standard conversion, like a modified conversion or a mutual holding company type acquisition. Those were reported, yet the Canada Trust proposal was not reported. The government had an interest here. What happened was, when the recapitalization proposal was entered into in 1986, the government forgave $158 million of debt by First Federal. The government put $200 million of assistance into the deal. And First Federal's obligation was to raise $150 million in capital as soon as practicable.
If they had reported this, as you say, they should have, what would the government have done differently than what it actually did?
If it had been reported, the government would have had an opportunity to weigh in on the proposal and perhaps persuade...
Is that a way? You don't say the government would have done anything specific that would have changed the outcome of what happened. You just say they would have had the opportunity to talk to these people and persuade them they should accept it?
Yes, two responses to that. That was a very important right of the government under this agreement. The government's interest was in having, number one, First Federal raise capital as quickly as possible and get its capital levels up to where they were supposed to be under the statute. And number two, the government had warrants to buy 25% of whatever stock was going to be issued in connection with this offering, and it was looking to recoup some of the $200 million investment it had made. Also, under at least this court's decision in Thomas v. Hudd, our responsibility is not to show that things would have been different. In that case, the government argued things wouldn't have been different if this breach happened, and this court found nonetheless that it was a material breach of contract. Here, the essence of the contract was First Federal's obligation to raise capital. The government had already done its part. If First Federal had had this opportunity and not disclosed it, and we had found out about it, at the time, it would have been within our rights to cease performance under the contract. That's a classic example of prior material breach. So therefore, there's no question that there was a prior material breach, and this court should reverse the trial court's holding otherwise. With respect to the Monroe acquisition, the plain language of the agreement governing the capital ratios that First Federal was subject to said that the reduced capital ratios applied to First Federal. Those reduced capital ratios did not apply to other Thrift. It only goes to First Federal's capital compliance. What First Federal is suggesting here is that it could go out and acquire several $5 or $6 billion capital deficient insolvent Thrifts, and that those Thrifts could do an end run around the capital regulations and say, hey, we've got deficient capital, but all we have to do is merge with First Federal and we can be subject to...
I think that's what their argument is. I understand their argument. They say, Section, what was it, 610?
Yes, Your Honor.
That Section 610 said, in effect, that in considering anything happening to First Federal, they would rely on the capital ratios set forth in that section, and therefore, when they said, no, we're going to turn Monroe down because we don't meet the higher standards under the new statute, that was inconsistent with what was set forth in the contract. That's as I understand their argument. I'm not saying you can go out anywhere and just buy it, say if you want to do it, and that's the issue. Whether somehow the regulators committed themselves in Section 610 that when they came to consider any applications for acquisitions, they would be guided by the standard in 610 and not by some other standard. That's the issue, isn't it?
That's the issue, and First Federal's interpretation is wrong. Section 6.10 was intended solely to protect First Federal from falling out of capital compliance because it did not, when the recapitalization took place in 1986, it was not at the statutory levels that were required at that time.
How are we supposed to know that? The first sentence in 610 is that the amount of network required for under the regulatory section or any successor regulation shall not be required of First Federal. How are we supposed to know?
The fees shall not be required of First Federal. what was happening with respect to the Monroe acquisition is that you were bringing in a thrift that wasn't even regulated by the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. It was an FDIC institution. It was capital deficient. It was essentially insolvent.
So you're saying that that first sentence is completely not applicable to any mergers or acquisitions? Because that would be...
Unless the merger partner met the statutory requirement.
Where are we supposed to glean that?
Because it states only that it applies to First Federal. What First Federal's interpretation of the contract says, this 1.09 reduced capital ratio set forth in Section 6.10 applies not only to us, but to anybody else out there who merges with us. That's not safe.
The consequence of their argument, but they're not saying that. All they're saying is that the statute, the contract provision is limited to looking at capital ratios and does not apply to a decision whether to authorize a merger.
And that's where they're wrong. If you look at Section 6.09, it says that all other regulatory standards apply. Now, the merger, the regulation that governed mergers did have a reference to Section 5.613 of the regulations, but it was talking about a merged association, not just First Federal itself. We're talking about an insolvent thrift that was going to be merging into First Federal. The whole point of these reduced ratios was to give First Federal... The agreement does not preclude mergers. However,
I'll ask you that question, whether it precludes. I ask you, is there anything in the agreement that sets a standard for mergers?
No. But that's really not relevant to this question, because the question is whether Section 6.10 would allow...
Maybe relevant.
Well, the government's position is that it's not relevant because Section 6.10 cannot be read to allow any thrift other than First Federal to have these reduced capital ratios. And in fact, the purpose of 6.10 was to prevent First Federal from having to enter into a supervisory agreement at the time of the recapitalization in 1986. At that time, notwithstanding the government's forgiveness of the debt and notwithstanding the government's $200 million in assistance, First Federal was so bad off that it still wasn't going to make the minimum statutory requirements, and that's why Section 6.10 is in there, and that's at page 200-208 of the record. Section 6.10, in combination with a capital plan that was attached at the back of the agreement, were to prevent First Federal the government taking action against First Federal for its failure to comply with the requirement, which is about 3%, that was in effect at that time. It was to protect First Federal and let it keep moving forward. It wasn't to allow it to take engage in collateral activities with unsafe and unsound other thrifts.
But
that were
how are we to glean that from anything in this agreement? I don't see anything in 6.10 that makes the argument that you just made.
Well, section 6.09, it states that during the term of this agreement, First Federal will comply with any and all other applicable statutes, regulations, orders, etc. of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board. Here, I mean...
Does that mean anything more than before attempting a merger that will get the approval of the regulatory bodies?
No, it means they're subject to all restrictions of all other regulations administered by the Federal Home Loan Bank Board.
What do you mean all other? Where's the other? What are the other?
Any and all applicants. It's page 274
of the... I don't mean it's 609.
During the term of this agreement, First Federal will comply with any and all applicable statutes, regulations, or orders of, or any restriction imposed by the United States. And if you skip down, it says, except as set forth in Section 6.10.
Right.
So, First Federal could not use 6.10 to avoid all other regulatory restrictions that the government could apply. Here, the government looked at this merger and decided that because Monroe was capital deficient, that it was not a safe and sound, it would not be a safe and sound activity for First Federal to merge with it. And First Federal was effectively viewed as having a forbearance, and even the regulations in effect in 1988 said that if you have a forbearance, You have to look very closely at the policy issues with trying to transfer that forbearance to another thrift. That was a concern of both the Federal Home Loan Bank Board and the FDIC, which was the
I suppose you could argue that there's nothing in this.
You know, I've noticed my time is.
That's all right.
I should say, I suppose you could argue that there's nothing in this agreement that in any way purports to limit the regulator's authority to apply its traditional standards in approving or disapproving a merger.
That's correct. The only thing that 6.0, 6.10 did was say the regulators could not take action against like a cease and desist order or a capital plan or any other action that it could normally take for a thrift that was capital deficient.
Well, with our assistance, you've exhausted your rebuttal time. But we'll restore 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And let's add 3 minutes to the first federalist time.
Morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, David Case of the law firm of K&L Gates, on behalf of First Federal Rochester and the FLE. Contracts are the lifeblood of commercial enterprise, and this case is really about the terms of a contract, the physical financing agreement, and the foreseeable consequences of the breach of that agreement. The first issue appellant raised was that the First Federal did not report the 1988 Canada Trust overture to regulatory authorities, and has termed this a prior material breach. We don't think A, it was a breach, and we certainly don't think it was material. We believe the trial court's judgment on this is fully supported by the record.
And one of your arguments, if I understand correctly, tell me if I'm right, is that 6.4 is limited to standard conversion.
Your Honor, we believe that the language of 6.4 is properly understood to encompass a standard conversion. The idea
to take that further, and the Canada, even if there were discussions or whatever, that didn't implicate a standard conversion.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Canada Trust conversion had to proceed as a modified conversion, not a standard conversion. The standard conversion would consist of an offering to depositors first, then an offering to the public. We believe that kind of conversion is what's implicated in the language and offering of common stock.
And as we asked the government's attorney, what is it in 6.4? Where's the language in 6.04 that we need us to limit it to speak?
Your Honor, I think the language that we point to there is the concept of common stock offering. A stock offering is an offering initiated by the First Federal. It's an offering that's a voluntary offering. And we believe it implicates to the public and to depositors, not what would happen in the context of a Canada Trust acquisition, where yes, it would have to convert from mutual form to common stock form, and then Canada Trust would take over 99% of the stock as
it
did.
But you're just reading the language in a narrow sense. Is there anything to suggest that that's a proper reading of that agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if the court wants to look beyond the agreement, the court can look to other tools. The Canal Memo, which was written, and that's how it was referred to commonly, in July of 1986, right before the first federal financing agreement, which set the grounds for and justified it to the regulatory authorities, said First Federal's goal is to undergo a standard conversion. And if you look at the capital plan, which is attached to the agreement, and which the government makes much about when it goes to foreseeability, that capital plan references things like access to the public markets, public offerings. Now, that is language, as a matter of logic, that would apply to a standard conversion. And it isn't just a matter of language and logic. The court looks at the testimony of Mr. Borshoff.
Security is still a private offering to a public offering. Correct, Your Honor. And you said that under this agreement, the reference to offering was to a public offering?
Yes, Your Honor, and the way we would get to that logic, Your Honor, is to look at the attachment of the capital plan, which refers specifically to the intent to access the public markets, Your Honor, and the public offerings. So in the dichotomy the court posed there, we believe that the capital plan indicates quite clearly that it's contemplated under 604 and by this agreement is a public offering, which in this context is a standard conversion.
Had the Canada Trust overture been accepted by the board, would there have been an obligation to disclose that?
Yes, I think, Your Honor, if the board had gone forward and looked at the Canada Trust and decided, in fact, yes, we're going to allow ourselves to be taken over, there would definitely have to be disclosure to the regulatory authorities in that context, both under 604 and otherwise.
So you would define progress as requiring as a threshold matter some imprimatur by the board of directors?
Yes, Your Honor, because so much discretion, in fact, all discretion is rested in the board of directors, it says the board shall have reasonably determined that it is in the best interest of First Federal to proceed with the conversion. And in that context, the testimony is Mr. Borshoff, the president, told Canada Trust we're not interested, but nevertheless, he went to the board and got confirmation that his reaction was the right one. And so the board, for reasons which were set forth in the judge's opinion, had decided not to go forward and not to pursue in any significant way Canada Trust until after the
breach. But if the government is correct, and I think it is, that it has an some stake, some financial interest of 25% or whatever, at the end game, why wouldn't they have wanted in 6-4 to assure themselves they could become aware of this, they could go lobby board of directors? I mean, if they have an ultimate interest in the way this comes out and the way Canada Trust came up, why shouldn't they have had the ability to go and make their position known, and why isn't that entirely consistent with what presumably is the intent of 604?
Well, Your Honor, if that was their interest and their intent to find out about every kind of overture that came in, and Mr. Vigna testified, and the government makes much of it, he says, I think they had an obligation to notify us of any overture of our capital into the institution. It doesn't say that, Your Honor. That's not what 604 says. They could have crafted 604 in such a way to say that exact terms. They didn't. And in fact, in this instance, they crafted 604 to rest sole discretion in the board of directors. Like in any company.
But there is ambiguity. I mean, we don't know whether progress means a baby step or whether it's... I mean, you're suggesting that progress only comes into play once the board of directors has approved something. They've approved it, and then anything what happens after that is progress for it. I mean, why should we necessarily accept that?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say progress is only if the board accepts, Your Honor. I would confess and say here that if the board considered it and said we are going to enter into negotiations with Canada Trust as to how they might acquire us, yes, then there should have been some indication to the regulator. But that's not what happened here, Your Honor. What happened in this instance was an overture in the context that the board considered and the board had the sole discretion. The board didn't want to move forward. There's no evidence, Your Honor, in this record that any testimony from any regulator that the board made an imprudent decision, that the board made an unreasonable decision, and there's no evidence.
That's not the issue before us. The issue is you entered into an agreement obligating yourself to apprise the government of something at some time. The government doesn't have to prove everything that you're suggesting.
Right, Your Honor, but in this context, the government can't show that there's any materiality to this breach at all because there was an overture that was properly considered. There was nothing to be done in response to the overture.
Did anybody ever meet with representatives of Canada, Canadian company?
Your Honor, what happened was...
Don't tell me what happened, just answer my question.
I will, Your Honor.
Did the board ever meet those?
Your Honor, the board ultimately authorized Mr. Borshoff to go meet people there and keep the options open.
I understand.
And then after...
The board did not meet with these people.
Not all the board together, Your Honor. What happened
was... There was no board meeting in which someone representing this company came in and said, let me tell you what we proposed.
after the breach, Your Honor, after FLRIA was enacted, after...
which was ultimately led to the final disposition.
Yes.
But at the time, with respect to these overtures that the government said you were required to report, there was no meeting between the board, which had final authority over these things, and representatives of the proposed possible loss of war.
There was no meeting before the board, Your Honor. That would be correct. Yes.
Let me turn to the second issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
We've got to reconcile 6.9 and 6.10. So why can't we fairly read 6.10 as only applying to First Federal's obligation to maintain the capital ratio, and then say 6.9 applies to mergers and acquisitions? What's wrong with that reading?
Your Honor, I think what 6.10 applies to is when there's a merger, a potential merger, and the resulting institution is First Federal, as it was going to happen in the Monroe case, the capital standards by which that resulting institution would be assessed.
Well, I'm not surprised if that's your position. The question is, what language are you pointing to that supports that? When there's a merger, you start off by saying, when 6.10 applies, when there's a merger. How
right.
Did we know that?
All right, Your Honor, we say our view is the language, the amount of net worth required for any successor regulation shall not be required of First Federal. All right, and then it later goes on First Federal to include successor institutions.
There's nothing in that in any way limits the regulatory authority's ability to impose as a condition to approve the merger. But they meet the descriptive standards that the statute can impose. There's nothing explicitly saying that. You said it should be read into that.
I think, Your Honor, that this language is binding on the government. And in 1986, what the government agreed to in 6.10 was that for capital requirements for First Federal, which would include First Federal as a successor, which was in the contract, the net worth required under 12 CFR shall not be required. Instead, it says, First Federal will be required to have a net worth liability ratio, and then it sets forth those specific ratios.
But I suggest to you, if it was intended that limitation could also apply to any merger acquisitions, they could easily set so. Including any application to merge or acquire, no savings at all. They didn't. When you read it, it sounds as though what they were looking at was only the capital requirements of First Federal.
Your Honor, I would respond to that in two ways. One is, I believe that First Federal means the Savings and Loan Association and any successors. So it would apply if once the merger is done.
It did apply, but the question is what applies?
The capital standards of 6.10. And the other evidence of that is replete in the record, is that's the way the Federal Home Loan Bank of New York analyzed the Monroe transaction prior to FLRIA. There were three occasions, at least, when the Federal Home Bank analyzed it. And the first one was in November of 88. They looked at the merged institution, Monroe and First Federal, and apply that merged institution against the capital standards of 6.10. And they looked and they said, well, it's going to decrease it slightly, but it's still well above 6.10. That should be fine. Second time they looked at it was in February of 89. They did the same thing, Your Honor. The Federal Home Loan Bank of New York, in a memo, looked at the merged institution to see if it met 6.10. And then in the digest, which is a much more formal document, they specifically indicated there was no limitations on merger in the financing agreement, there was no supervisory objection, and that it met all regulatory standards for approval. So when the regulators, prior to FLRIA, looked at the merger, they looked at it in the context of, does the institution that winds up, First Federal here, meet 6.10, not other capital standards. I believe that would be, I would try to answer your question that way, the best evidence of how 6.10 should be interpreted is how the Federal Home Loan Bank Board of New York looked at this time and time again.
But that was the Federal of New York, that was not the agency that had authority to approve this merger, was it?
Your Honor, ultimately, they did not have the authority to approve it, Your Honor, but they were the ones who monitored this, the application of the financing agreement. They were the ones on the ground who worked with it most definitely. And our view is exactly what the court said. The problem is that when the bank board, or at that time OTS, came to look at the regulatory and look at the capital standards applied to the merged institution, they did not look under 610. In fact, they looked under 4E. And that is the breach we're looking at. Your Honor, I'm running short of time. Unless the court has more questions, I'm happy to answer. I'll just briefly address the issue of foreseeability here. Does the court have any additional questions on the merger or the trust overture? On the foreseeability, Your Honor, once again, we would point out that this is a question of fact. Everyone agrees on that. And there was clearly growth, significant growth foreseen. In 1986, while still a Phoenix with limited growth, the court looks at the budget at A300093, and it's $348 million.
Yes, the government argues that our case law requires that you look at both the type and the magnitude of the damages for foreseeability.
Yes.
Take issue with that? Do you agree with that?
Your Honor, we believe that, yes, there is some limitation on magnitude. What does magnitude mean? That's, I guess, one of the nubs here.
Well, we've demonstrated today we don't know what any of
it is. Look.
Our cases do, you know, there is case law, right? I mean,
right.
Okay.
Your Honor, and we believe there, you know, there, in this context, if you look at the magnitude of damages and what was foreseeable, we believe that it is foreseeable in the magnitude.
And you're looking at four times the projection. In terms of your position is what was foreseeable was four times projected.
Yes, Your Honor, and I guess I would, as an advocate, quarrel with the assumption in the court's question, which is that these projections indicated any sort of limit or any sort of expectation on the part of the government.
Well, they may not have been a limit, but they certainly reflect the foreseeability in terms of growth.
Your Honor, there was no testimony in the record of any government regulator that these reflected the expectations of the government. In fact, I think what properly reflects the expectations of the government on growth is the growth that you could accomplish under the capital ratios of 610.
What did those projections reflect?
Your Honor, they reflected, according to the testimony of Mr. Chaplin, they were intended as conservative assumptions to demonstrate that once this was done, First Federal would be a viable institution, even if it failed to reach its objectives. I mean, its objective at $348 million of growth as a phoenix in 1986, which is roughly 8% of its capital base.
You agree, I take it, that foreseeability includes not only the fact of damages will also be announced?
Not the precise amount, Your Honor, but some sense of a magnitude here. And I think what was...
If the amount of profit was not 3 or 4 times, but 100 times, you would agree that wouldn't have been foreseeable.
Exactly, Your Honor, and the reason it
wouldn't
be...
How does one draw the line? What, at this point, if it increases 20%, 50%, 100%, is that for the trier of fact to determine on the basis of all the evidence?
I think it's an issue for the trier of fact to determine. And I also think here we have the outward bound of what is foreseeable encompassed in the capital ratios of 610. They could only grow to the extent they did not put in jeopardy the capital ratios in 610. And the evidence of that, Your Honor, it's in the record, it's very clear, is in July of 1989, First Federal made one of these semi-annual reports that we looked at. And it says, as such, the capital level could support an association with assets approaching $12 billion and still meet the terms of the agreement. In contrast, the associate has undertaken a strategy of modest growth in a range of 10 to 12% since 1986. And has fashioned its bag of business activities in support of this level of growth. Mr. Vigna, the regulator, testified A100450 that he agreed they could have been growing much more right up to their capital ratio, but that they were doing it conservatively. Mr. Pallant, who testified about those numbers in the financing agreement, said they weren't limits. All the growth had to be done in a prudent fashion.
I have a question. If the government were to prevail in its foreseeability argument, would that wipe out all the damages or just a portion?
Well, certainly, Your Honor, it doesn't address the damages that relate to Monroe. It doesn't relate to the damages that were connected with the capital trust transaction, restructuring assets, fees. And with regard to lost profits, it doesn't eliminate all those because our calculus, the way we looked at it, you would have to start, okay, in 1990, we forewent the growth there.
If we were to hold that the profits were not foreseeable, that would reduce the damages, but not eliminate.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
On that note, your time has expired. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
First, with respect to Monroe, the government reserved all rights not specifically given out in Section 6.10. The government jealously reserves its rights to regulate the safety and soundness of thrift institutions. And given the possible enormous impact that plaintiff's interpretation of Section 6.10 could have in a merger context, there's absolutely no way that the language of the agreement can justify Judge Miller's finding that an insolvent merger partner could merge with First Federal and take advantage of these capital ratio that was only one-third that was required under the regulations. Further, Mr. Pease mentioned several times that, well, the agreement applied to successors, so therefore it had to apply to First Federal and its merger partner. Well, that reference to successors would be to a successor like Canada Trust. Now, it may be arguable that if Canada Trust had actually purchased First Federal in 1989, that it would be able to enjoy Section 6.09. But we're not talking about a merger application that had to be reviewed for safety and soundness and with an insolvent thrift. With respect to the prior material breach argument, first, with respect to Mr. Plaintiff's counsel's argument that 6.04 only applied to standard conversions, the plain language of the agreement applies to any conversion, and it also applies to all common stock offerings. And what Mr. Case did not mention is that the definition of offering document in the agreement itself applied to both public offerings and private placements. So what Judge Friedman said earlier is absolutely applicable here. Also, First Federal itself in 1991, when it finally did the modified conversion with Canada Trust, reported it under Section 6.04. Its semi-annual report made at that time said we're providing this report in accordance with 6.04.
It was an actual agreement.
It was, but
I don't suppose anyone questions that if the earlier negotiations had resulted in an agreement, that would have been reported. The question is whether the mere fact there weren't negotiations, there were just inquiries and importunities, whether that had to be reported.
Your Honor, I would say that there were negotiations here because the Strategic Planning Committee authorized Mr. Borshoff to pursue the proposal and to get more information. Also, by saying that there had to be an actual approval of a deal to go forward, would write the notice provision out of the agreement. And that would mean once you have a completed common offering proposal, come give us notice then. And that's not what it says. It says progress toward a common stock offering. And finally, with respect to foreseeability, the capital ratios in 6.10 do not govern foreseeability. The agreement in 6.11 said that the capital plan, which had First Federal reaching the statutory minimums, was what First Federal was to be governed by, not 6.10 in its growth. It couldn't engage in rampant growth without violating another provision of the agreement. 6.11 said, we will make every effort to comply with our capital plan. The capital plan had the statutory minimums, which it was supposed to reach by raising capital. And it also said, even if market conditions are not ideal for a conversion. We will take every step to reach the statutory minimums as soon as possible. So you can't read the agreement as allowing them to, in effect, lever down through growth to the 6.10 minimums when those minimums were only to protect them from adverse action by the government. And also the July 1989 report, which Plaintiffs' Counsel made reference to, that July 1989 report is a post-recapitalization document. What we're looking at is the government's expectations at the time that the recapitalization agreement was entered into in 1986. At that time, no one was projecting 13% growth by First Federal in 1989. The projections were around 2 to 3%. It had never grown by more than 4 or 5%. So there was absolutely no way that the government could reasonably have foreseen the magnitude of the growth that Judge Miller assumed when he awarded lost profits based upon the 13%.
Okay, thank you very much. That is part of the case is submitted.